Well, good afternoon. It's time for us to start this talk on the Division of Labor and Social Order. And let me start with just a brief remark on the latter part of the title, The Social Order. We heard Tom Woods last night wax eloquent about the market economy and the social order produced by the market economy. And I think he expressed all of our awe, or at least appreciation, for the magnificent accomplishments of the market economy. I just wanted to add, as we go into this discussion about the division of labor, that economics as a discipline was actually born in the insight that society, under certain configurations at least, that is, the market, under that configuration, is a natural order. That it works, in other words, through the natural inclination of humans to strive by human action to attain their ends. And that this this was not something like a the recognition of this was not something like an empirical, you know, observation that the first economists made in the 14th century, but was a firmly held presupposition that the nature of the world was configured in such a way that there were laws of human action. And that these laws of human action that stem from human nature itself implied certain consequences. And one of these consequences was that we can engage in production in a division of labor. We can engage in social production without central command, as Dr. Woods was explaining last night. In fact, I dare say that this insight is perhaps the central insight of being an economist. If you're an economist, you think that there is such a thing as a natural order in society. The society is a natural order, and it works, so to speak, by itself. That is to say, we make it work in our actions and interactions. And, of course, the big point of debate among all economists, if we define economists this way, is whether or not the government is, or the state, the apparatus of compulsion and coercion, is necessary for defending person and property, or whether it's not necessary at all, because we just get along without it, period. By the way, I'll leave as an exercise for your own application, given my claim about what constitutes being an economist, whether some prominent modern self-identified economists are really economists or not. You can do that as an exercise. All right, so we want to talk about the division of labor. And we'll just start again with some definitions and some basic principles, and then we'll move on to some illustrations. We'll go through the logistics of the theory of the division of labor. And when we talk about the division of labor, we're talking, the idea of the division of labor is that we have production by people not for their solely for their own consumptive ends. So anytime people are engaged in production to satisfy the consumptive ends of other people, then we have a division of labor. So only in self-sufficient production would we lack a division of labor. Now, we've already seen in this morning's lecture that all action is predicated upon the recognition by the person choosing to act of a difference in value between alternatives. The person sees that as a means, and he could apply it in different ways, and one alternative has more value to him, and another alternative less. And he chooses the more alternative and sets aside the less alternative. And so to choose whether or not to be self-sufficient in production or to enter into a division of labor would be based upon the same consideration. The person would just look at the two alternatives and say, there's a value difference between the two alternatives, so I choose one course or the other. So all the complete explanation of the division of labor is based simply upon existing differences in the alternatives. Now, we can identify these differences, again, with an illustration. So we'll use Caruso and introduce Friday, and we'll just do this again in a very basic way, but it should be pointed out that this could be extended, and I'll make comments suggestive of this. This could be extended to all the complexity of real social life as we experience it. So anyway, just to reiterate from this morning, so we have Caruso's production with his labor. This is the marginal physical product of labor. In coconut gathering and berry picking, so these are the same numbers we had this morning. You can apply one unit of labor and get six coconuts by climbing the short trees nearby. And then once he's exhausted that, if he wants more, he has to apply another unit of labor. He can get a smaller output and so on. He applies his first unit of labor to berry picking. He goes to the most robust berry bushes nearby. Once he exhausts those, he applies another unit of labor. He goes to a less productive area of berry picking and so on. So it all looks like this. Each entry then, we're assuming in the chart, takes one unit of labor with the complementary factors of production. Now we introduce Friday. He has a marginal physical product of labor. The assumption that we need in order to see the what differences we're speaking about is we'll assume in the chart that each person, Caruso and Friday, has identical complementary factors of production. So the coconut tree configuration for Friday is the same as the coconut tree configuration for Caruso. The berry bush configuration for Friday is the same as the berry bush configuration for Caruso. That's so we have a pure comparison between the differences of their labor productivity. Right, so again, this is just an imaginary construct where we're trying to isolate these different causal factors involved in the differences between productivity and then what effects occur when people choose to take advantage of these differences. So we wouldn't want, for example, to do the comparison where Caruso had all the short coconut trees with lots of coconuts in them, and Friday had all the tall coconut trees with not very many coconuts at the top. Right? We're saying that their complementary factors of production are the same. So the differences we see are just based upon their labor. And we can see that we've suggested here the most difficult case that we could imagine analyzing. Well, actually, perhaps there are two cases of equal difficulty, but this seems to be a very difficult case of seeing exactly how Caruso and Friday would configure a division of labor for their mutual benefit. Where are the value differences that make a mutually advantageous division of labor possible in this case? So again, just to list out the possible configurations we could have, we could have the easy case. The easy case would be one person is more productive in the production of one of the goods with the complementary factors, and the other person is more productive in the production of the other good with the same complementary factors. If our chart was that Caruso could produce a lot of coconuts and Friday could produce a lot of berries. But we didn't do that example, right? Because that example, that's just easy to see that they could divide their labor by having each one produce what they're more proficient at and that their output would rise. Okay, so that's simple. We want to take this more difficult case. This is the second possible case. This case is where, as you can see, Caruso is more proficient at producing both goods. He can produce as an absolute amount more of coconuts than Friday for each labor unit allocated. And he can produce more berries than Friday for any given allocation of labor into berry production. So that represents the more difficult case. Just to suggest how this would be applied to the world we live in, this would be a case where we had like a very productive country like the United States trading with a much less productive country for whatever reason, like, Afghanistan. why would a very productive, you know, people who are very productive and could produce more of any, you know, everything than other people, why would they ever engage in a division of labor with these less productive persons, right? That's the difficult case. So that's the case we've taken. Now, there is a third case. A third case would be where the two parties that were contrasting and comparing have exactly the same production schedules. So Caruso and Friday would just be clones of one another productively, but they have different preferences. And so they exploit, each one of them exploits their production down into the lower marginal physical product areas of their productive activity. Because, for example, let's say Caruso really likes coconuts, and so he devotes all his labor to coconut production. And Friday really likes berries, so he devotes all of his production to berry, labor to berry production. If that's the case, differences would exist at the margin, and they could engage in beneficial trade. This, again, in the real world, is how you explain trade between people in different countries that are very similar. How is that possible? How do you explain trade between people in the United States and people in Germany who have similar productivity in different things? Well, it might be that their preferences are different, and so in the U.S., we exploit the production of something, if we're in isolation, to an extent that we've lowered the marginal physical product tremendously of doing that. And the Germans have done this with another good that they think, like beer making, right? So they lower the production tremendously of that, and we lower the production tremendously of automobiles or something. And then when we come in contact with each other and we think we can trade with each other, there are value differences to exploit, and we can be made better off by doing this sort of thing. So we can cover all the difficult cases in the real world. All we need, again, is the basic assumption that there are differences in productivity, and in particular, differences in efficiency. This is a key, as we'll see in a minute. So I put these two words on the slide, right? Proficiency and efficiency. Proficiency is just the amount of the good that a person can produce with the complementary factors. So Caruso is proficient enough that he can produce 6 coconuts with the complementary factors, a unit of his labor, and Friday can produce 5. So we say Caruso's more proficient than Friday in coconut gathering. He's also more proficient in berry picking. Efficiency has to do with cost. The efficient producer is the low-cost producer. And cost, of course, in human action is opportunity cost. It's the value of the thing given up. And so I've made their costs different too, right? So, for example, if Caruso produces 6 coconuts with 1 unit of labor, a first unit of labor, he gives up 2 berries. So he's giving up 3 coconuts per unit of berries. If Friday produces, he could produce 5 coconuts or half a quart of berries. So if he produces coconuts, he gives up half a quart of berries. That's 10 coconuts per quart of berry. So we can see that Friday is a much higher cost producer of berries than Caruso. And we can take advantage of that difference, the difference in opportunity costs, to the mutual advantage of the two parties. So any time there are differences in efficiencies, then it's possible to engage in a division of labor and actually increase physical productivity. Okay, so this is the next step that we want to see. Now, in order to give the full example of this, we'll assume something about the demand for the products. Because the demand for the products, again, will dictate the extent to which production is moved down from the more efficient to the less efficient areas, and hence the efficiency differences. So let's presume, just for the start of this, that Caruso and Friday have the same basic preferences, but they have these different production schedules. And they allocate labor, 1 unit to coconut gathering and 2 units to berry picking. So if Caruso does this in isolation, he'll get 6 coconuts and 3.5 quarts of berries. If Friday does the same thing, he'll get 5 coconuts and 1 quart of berries. So that's how we're going to start in self-sufficiency. Okay, so it looks like this. Caruso allocates his 3 units of labor. He gets 6 coconuts, 3.5 berries, 3.5 quarts of berries. Friday does the same pattern of allocation. He gets 5 coconuts, 1 quart of berries. So their total production is 11 coconuts, 6 plus 5, and 4.5 quarts of berries, 3.5 plus 1. But you'll notice that their costs are quite different. Their opportunity cost for producing berries is radically different. So again, if we go back to here, we see that if Caruso is producing at this point and this point, then this production of berries, he's producing here. If he wants to extend berry production, he'll get one more quart of berries and he would give up 6 coconuts. So his cost for producing one more quart of berries is 6 coconuts per quart of berries. Friday's right here and right here. So if he produces more berries, he goes down to get 1/4 of a quart of berries, but he gives up 5 coconuts. So that's a cost of 20 coconuts per quart of berries, right? So they're radically different in costs. Caruso is a much lower cost producer of berries than Friday. So obviously you have these cost differences. What should you do? What would be the economizing thing to do? It would be to allocate production to the low-cost producer. That's what the division of labor does. That's how these two, Caruso and Friday, would derive mutual benefit from their social interaction, from entering into a division of labor with each other. Okay, so let's see what happens when they do that. Let's say that both of them again just desire to allocate 3 units of labor to the production of coconut and berries. So Caruso, since he's a lower cost berry producer, he's going to give up producing 6 coconuts and produce 1 more quart of berries. So he's going to produce 2, 1.5, 1. That's how he's going to allocate his 3 units of labor. And so in total, he'll get 4.5 quarts of berries. And then Friday is going to give up berry production, and he's going to move to coconut production. And so he gets 5 plus 4 plus 3, and he doesn't produce any berries at all. So he gets 9 plus 3, 12. So now let's summarize this. This is production in the division of labor. Caruso allocates his 3 units of labor. He doesn't produce any coconuts because he's specialized now in berry production because he's a low-cost producer of berries. He gets 4.5 quarts of berries. Friday goes the other way. Right? Because he's not efficient in berry production, he moves into coconut production, he gets 12 coconuts. And now the group gets 12 coconuts and 4.5 quarts of berries. They increase their physical output in the division of labor because their differences in the physical efficiencies of their conditions to begin with. So they're doing exactly the same thing that everybody does in every action. They're seeing a value difference between two options, and they're moving away from the lower value to the higher valued option. And by doing that, they gain. And here, the thing to notice, of course, is that here, they gain not only in utility. In fact, we haven't even explained how they gain in utility yet. They gain in physical production. With a given inputs, they're actually producing more output now in the division of labor than they did in self-sufficiency when we add up all their output. So this is the key. This is the key insight. Now, the other question that we can address right here with this example is, how far should this specialization go? As we mentioned before, the more that Caruso specializes in berry production, the lower his marginal physical product goes. And so he becomes less and less efficient at the margin when he extends his production. The same thing, again, happens in the real world. Most of you know that America, compared to the rest of the world, has some efficiency advantage in the abstract in agricultural production. So the question is, look, if the most efficient corn-growing region in the whole world is eastern Nebraska, that's why they call them the Cornhuskers, then exactly how far should this specialization go of American land in corn farming? Because corn can be grown in other areas that aren't as efficient, right? And the answer is it depends on demand. It depends on world demand. So if world demand is great enough to outstrip the production of the eastern Nebraska corn farmers, then corn production would be extended to less physically productive areas. And that would still be the most efficient thing to do, right? So it should be produced there and so on until the efficiencies are at the margin roughly equated. So the corn could be produced, I don't know, in other places in the world as well that aren't quite as efficient. In other areas in the U.S. that aren't quite as efficient as eastern Nebraska farmland. By the way, just as an aside on this, if you're wondering, well, what difference would this make? This is a point that will be talked about in lectures later in the week. If you're wondering what difference does this make in prices, the answer is that it won't make any difference in the rate of return, the interest return from investing in these different efficiency areas. But Nebraska farmland will command a higher price than farmland in western Iowa, because it's more efficient. That's where the difference will manifest itself in the market. Okay, so the answer is here again, I've done the calculation. The answer is they'll extend their specialization until the efficiency is the same. So again, when Friday is producing nothing but coconuts, he's gone 5-4-3. If he were to shift now out of coconuts and into berry production, he would lose 3 coconuts, he would gain 0.5 quart of berries. That's a rate of 6 coconuts per berry production. That's the same rate at which Caruso is producing berries, the same efficiency rate at which Caruso is producing berries when he produces the last quart of berries. So at that point, they will stop and they won't specialize further, because specializing further would actually be detrimental to physical production. By the way, it follows from this that it isn't fundamentally in specialization itself that generates the gain in productivity. The gain in productivity comes when people specialize according to the efficiency that exists in their different production processes. We would not increase overall output if we had all of the oranges grown in Nebraska and all of the corn grown in Florida. Specialization doesn't do us any good per se, at least not necessarily. It's that we have to identify the value attached to these different alternatives. Okay, so now let's go on to the effects of the division of labor. And so this is the first effect we were just demonstrating, right? We can now define the division of labor more exactly. The division of labor is not just when people produce to satisfy the consumptive ends of other people. A division of labor is specialized production according to efficiency. It's when people recognize their efficient areas and move into those, and not just, again, producing for the consumptive benefit of other people. And as we've seen, specialization in this sense increases productivity. But again, this is only because there are efficiency differences that can be taken advantage of. Now, the second line here explains how the two parties benefit from their specialized endeavors. Because remember, they don't wish to consume what they're producing. Their desires, remember with Caruso and Friday, their desires for consumption were they wanted a certain amount of coconuts and a certain amount of berries. They wanted to split, their demands were split between the two. But when they divide their labor and specialize, they're producing exclusively, in our example, one good or the other. Caruso is producing only berries and Friday only coconuts. But they don't wish to consume this way, right? So if they're going to benefit from the division of labor, they have to be able to trade. And one possible, of course, given the fact that they've produced more output, it's always possible for them to trade and both be better off. It's just a question of what exchange rate they would trade at. So again, this is just discovered on the part of people who wish to engage in the division of labor to get this greater productivity. They can figure out what the exchange rate is and then mutually agree to do it, because both of them would be made better off. So, for example, Caruso could trade 1 quart of berries for 6.5 coconuts. And if he did this, he would wind up with 6.5 coconuts and 3.5 berries. And Friday could trade 6.5 coconuts for 1 quart of berries, and he would end up with 5.5 coconuts and 1 quart of berries, which is half a coconut better than they started out with for each of them. There could be other exchange ratios that would be mutually beneficial. So trade and the division of labor are linked together. We'll follow up on this point in a minute. Now, the third point I have here says that specialization may augment or degrade efficiency. Once people begin to specialize, then it may be that through processes, let's say, of learning or of practice, or say the people who specialize their labor might, again, become more productive because they specialize as they learn how to do the activity better and so on. Or it may be that their land, they learn ways to cultivate it better to increase their productivity as they advance in concentrating on just producing certain goods. So this is possible. It's certainly possible that specialization could augment the efficiency differences and then lead to even more intense exploitation of these differences in efficiency. It's also possible, though, that specialization could degrade efficiency. This is just an open empirical question. So lefties like to point out that, you know, our lefty friends, they like to point out that, you know, working on the assembly line all day, and it's boring, and people make mistakes, and, you know, you get cars that are defective, and or you have all these farmers in Nebraska, and all they do is produce corn, so they wear the soil out, and so on and so forth. But the point is, again, to treat human beings, as Tom Woods said last night, as human beings. To treat human beings as real human beings who see these problems and react to them, to solve them. So naturally, if you were an entrepreneur and you were running an auto factory and you saw that your workers were becoming bored and making mistakes, you would move them around, right? Or you would self-select the different workforce. I have a friend who a few years ago retired from a job he had with a gas company. And he moved to Arkansas and, you know, wanted to get a part-time job. He got a part-time job on an assembly line, where he just mindlessly, you know, put widgets together or something. I don't even know what it was. He just, you know, makes this connection, and then the thing moves along, and he does it again. And I asked him one day, I said, doesn't this drive you crazy? Aren't you just bored out of your mind? And he says, no. He says, no, I think of other things when I'm doing this, and I can do that at the same time that I'm technically accurate, and it's actually quite soothing and calming. There are people like this. And we are different, right? And they'll self-select into these jobs. That's what the division of labor, that's how they would solve this problem, or one of the ways in which this problem would be addressed in the market. Now we get to the principle of the law of association. The law of association is taking this idea of the division of labor and furthering it to a social theory, really, this theory of social order. And the first point to make, and again, we're just dealing with the technical aspects of this, but the first point to make is the one I have written here, is that each factor is efficient in some line of production. That while it's possible for Caruso to be more proficient than Friday in both lines of production, it's not possible for him to be more efficient in both lines of production. So as we saw before, the efficiency calculation for Caruso and Friday producing berries was that Caruso gave up 6 coconuts to produce another unit of berries, and Friday gave up 20 coconuts per unit of berries. That's what made Friday the high-cost producer of berries. But if we were to calculate their costs of producing coconuts, if we were to invert the calculation, then those ratios would simply invert, right? So if Caruso trades 6 coconuts for 1 quart of berries, he trades 1 quart of berries for 6 coconuts. And if Friday trades 20 coconuts for 1 quart of berries, he trades 1 quart of berries for 20 coconuts, right? So this makes him a very low-cost producer of coconuts. Why? Not because he can produce a lot of coconuts, because he doesn't give up very much to produce coconuts. And so his opportunity cost is low. So one person cannot have efficiency advantages over another person in everything. This is just not possible. It's a mathematical law of reciprocals. If you have 2 ratios and they're different and you take the reciprocal ratios, the inequality will reverse for all ratios, right? So if there are differences in efficiencies, one person more efficient than another in one thing, we calculate the other efficiency of the other good, the efficient producer will be the other person, right? Since the ratio will invert. Now, what this means, of course, is that it's always possible, no matter how slight the productivity of a person, for a person to enter into the division of labor, to outcompete everybody else, because that person is the most efficient producer of something. So, for example, just another stylistic example, suppose we assume, for the sake of my example, that Tim Cook is a great carpenter. He's a great handyman, and he can produce, carpentry-skilled works, cabinetry for kitchens and so on and so forth, at say, twice the productivity of the local carpenter in Grove City. His name is Frank Weintraub. Would that mean that he would push Frank Weintraub out of a job? Would this leave no room for poor Frank in the division of labor because Tim Cook is more productive than him in all these different things that he could do? Well, no, because no local carpentry company is going to hire Tim Cook to come and do carpentry work in Grove City. They would have to pay him $500 million an hour or whatever he gets for running Apple. He's a very high-cost carpenter. And Frank Weintraub doesn't lose sleep at night, worrying about Tim Cook come taking his job. No, there's room for everyone in the division of labor. There is, by the way, a caveat to that principle. And the caveat is that this principle is true as long as the human population is not large enough to fill all of the Earth's surface with productive activity. In other words, as the Earth is configured now, human population can all be employed, and we have sub-marginally productive land. We have huge tracts of land that are not used for anything. They're just idle. Well, we could put productive activity on this land, in the Rocky Mountains or, what do they do in Canada? So we could, we can put more productive stuff in northern Canada or Alaska or whatever. And, we're not doing that now. So the human population hasn't grown to the point where it's necessary to take up every surface area of the planet in productive activity. If that were true, then this principle of the law of association would not follow, right? Then if that were true, if the human population exceeded the actual surface area of productive activity on the surface of the Earth, then we would have sub-marginally productive labor. We'd have some people who could not find a place in the division of labor, and they would be permanently unemployed. Again, some of our lefty friends think this way about the world, right? It's overpopulated, and you have these masses of unemployable people and so on. But actually, the world is not configured this way. Now, let me make one other point about this. Making these points as suggestive to use to sort of think about and muse over, as opposed to fully explaining, right? The other thing is that it depends whether or not every square inch of surface of the Earth is taken up with productive activity depends upon the nature of our productive activity. So, for example, when we were, when the normal production processes were primitive, hunting and gathering and agriculture and herdsman activity and so on, the possibility of the human population to cover the Earth with productive activity was fairly low, right? The human population that would have covered all of the Earth with viable productive activity was fairly small. I don't know how reliable this figure is, but I've always heard that when the Europeans came and discovered the New World, that the number of Indians living in what is now the United States was on the order of maybe 2 to 10 million, hunting and gathering and primitive agriculture and so on. Well, 10 million people live in New York City, right? Because we have this extended capitalist production system. So it depends, right? The law of association, in other words, it seems naturally, according to the progress of the market, would probably never be exceeded. That is, we'd never have this problem where the law of association was not true. The human population would never grow to the point where it exceeded the productive capacity of the planet. Again, I throw that out just for your consideration. Let me make one last point about this. It follows from this, if we're correct about this, it follows that there should not be, on the market, there should not be something like natural unemployment. People could be willingly unemployed, right? You'd have people retire, or you guys could take a year off of after you graduate from college and tour in Europe or whatever. But we wouldn't consider that problematic unemployment. There should be none of that. That should not be a natural condition of the market. If we, again, as economists, when we see unemployment as a problem, we naturally point the finger not at the market, but at something else. Why? Because the market is a natural order where people would naturally avoid this. There's no inherent reason for it, in our world at least. Okay, so we know that employment can be indefinitely expanded as long as the market is working to accumulate capital and so on. That isn't problematic. Okay, now let's look at limits to the division of labor. And one of these is the extent of the market. So this was one of the great insights of Adam Smith, right? Division of labor can develop only to the extent of the market. And we know, again, just from economic theory, from just an investigation of theoretical considerations in economics, that if we were left to our own devices, if we were given our full human dignity as human beings and not interfered with through coercive power, that there would be one world economy, that we would integrate all of our economic activity into one gigantic division of labor that included everybody in the world. And all the possible value differences that existed then among people could be exploited. And we could be as efficient in production as humanly possible. This would be the natural condition of the market economy. So anything that interferes with this natural development of integrating the world economy into one trading, gigantic trading relationship, one division of labor, would then limit the extent of the division of labor. And obviously, government intervention is the archetypical case of this. So the government intervention in trade, if they prevent trade through coercive means, then they actually make us physically less productive. It isn't just that we don't get to buy those great Japanese cars if they put a big, tariff on Japanese imports. It's that the world becomes less physically productive. Our standards of living are actually suppressed by this. We don't lose just utility, but we lose the advantage of using our inputs in the most productive fashion. And the other limitation that we want to mention, well, I've already alluded to this, right, is the extent of saving and investing. Because it's through saving and investing that capital accumulates and we get more and more indirect production. So we move from direct production, this primitive Caruso kind of hunting and gathering and primitive agriculture and so on. We move then to indirect production, where we can engage in stages of production to produce capital and then longer and longer stages of production. Again, since we are human beings, we're creative and we have intellect and judgment and so on, there doesn't seem to be naturally in the market any limitation to this. We don't, right? Once we have a market economy, then saving and investing can proceed ad infinitum, as long as we're desirous of it doing so. It seems to be, even though the government has heavily interfered with this process, that we've been doing pretty well anyway. We've been more and more productive. We accumulate capital in the world year by year, and only government intervention impedes this process. Okay, so now let's talk about overcoming the limits to the division of labor. And we want to pay some special attention to accumulating capital, since this is, again, more on topic with respect to the development of the division of labor. But first, we can just point out the initial idea from the last slide, that if we want to overcome the division of the limitations of the division of labor, then we have to eliminate state intervention in trade. That would be the first step, because the government, state intervention, can forcibly prevent people from trading. I already mentioned the case of tariffs. So tariffs forcibly prevent us from trading, and that means that value differences still exist between the peoples who would have traded otherwise. That could be exploited, right? We could buy all those great Japanese cars, and we could reconfigure the division of labor to get greater productivity out of both the production processes in the U.S. and the production processes in Japan, or whatever it might be, you know, cell phones in Korea or whatever. Right? So if they're tariffs or quotas or other kinds of interferences, what the government does is create a permanent legal wedge, creating value differences that we can't exploit unless we're willing to break the law, yeah, in which case we would exploit them less efficiently than if it were permitted legally for us to do this. The government can also, through state intervention, can forcibly require us to trade. And that, too, would then diminish the division of labor. We could be forced into trading with other people for which there are no value differences. We could be forced to trade anyway. Right? And what would happen if we do that is it would create, again, this artificial value difference. We would trade, you know, more extensively than we choose to voluntarily, and we would push the efficiencies away from their greatest level. We would become less efficient through this kind of thing. Regulations do this or can do this. Sometimes production subsidies could do this. So certain people are subsidized, and then they trade with other people when they wouldn't have otherwise, and this distorts the efficient production patterns. Now, this leaves open the question, by the way, as to what would be the process in the market of overcoming the limits of the division of labor if they're naturally arising. We said again that in every action, we're always going to aim to exploit a value difference. What if there are value differences that are naturally arising that people don't initially exploit? Should we have some kind of a policy to eliminate those? A classic example of this in the economics literature is transaction costs. You know, there are costs for making transactions, trading costs, right? Or there are transportation costs would be another example. And because of transportation costs or transaction costs, there can be residual value differences. So down here in the South, and it may be for other reasons than this, but I'll use this as an illustration. Down here in the South, I just noticed that gasoline prices are quite a bit lower than they are back up in the Northeast, in Pennsylvania, where I'm from. So they're 30 cents, 40 cents a gallon lower here. Now, that's a significant value difference that might be exploited if we just had a market. It might be worth it for the sellers to shift supply, right, and to move it. It might be that transportation costs create some of this difference, though. And maybe even if we had a free market, there would still be a dime's difference worth of, you know, in gas prices in Pennsylvania versus Texas or something of the sort. So the question is, should we strive somehow to eliminate that difference? Should we force people to eliminate the transaction costs? Should the government absorb it socially and eliminate transportation costs among the private producers? Well, clearly, again, the answer is no to this. The answer is no. These value differences should remain until we figure out how to reduce transportation costs or transaction costs. Then they would naturally be eliminated in the same process that all costs are reduced over time. These differences, too, could be based on subjective considerations. So differences in valuations could exist. Mises and Rothbard like to use the example of higher rental prices in New York City compared to the countryside. And there's value differences. So why aren't those completely exploited? Why don't all the consumers? And again, there's government interference in increasing the supply of housing in the city and so on. But it might just be that subjectively people value things in such a way that we get these differences that are permanent, or at least not easily dissolved. And if that's the case, well, we should just leave them alone, right? And let people figure this out for themselves. You hear this kind of complaint again from our lefty friends about economic imperialism of America. So, you know, we export our rock music, our rotten, you know, culture to innocent places in the world and corrupt them. You know, and well, we shouldn't do this. But again, so economic theory would say, well, no, it just depends on how people choose. Right? It's true that if the government's subsidizing the rotten music, well, we should eliminate that. But you know, if it's coming about naturally, no, that's fine. And if there are people who want to live in without this, like again in Pennsylvania, we have big Amish communities. Well, they don't play rock music and listen to their, you know, big stereo systems or whatever. Okay, that's fine, right? So we wouldn't say, well, no, we have to eliminate the value difference inherent in that by forcing them to adopt our culture. So my point just being, again, I'm just trying to suggest lines of inquiry that this analysis of economics applies to. It seems like a kind of a narrow argument that we make at first, but you can see that it has more robust results. Then the second point, we want to eliminate economic decision-making by state officials, right? We want decision-making to be entrepreneurial because, as we've talked about in the talk this morning and more later in the week, entrepreneurs can appeal to economic calculation. So they can look in the market and see what consumers value more highly relative to other things. They see the configuration of prices of producer goods, and they can make comparisons that are relevant to satisfying our preferences with respect to these value differences that emerge. Government officials, of course, do nothing of the sort. So they're just involved in making decisions that, from the perspective of economizing, are completely arbitrary. Again, just think of the difference between Tim Cook and making decisions about iPads. And so he's produced the iPad Mini, and it's a wild success, and they're satisfying our preferences and rolling in the dough. And using these, you know, plowing these funds back into production of more things that we desire to have and so on, versus something like public education, where, yeah, lots of dough's being poured in, but preferences aren't being satisfied. Everybody's dissatisfied because government officials don't make decisions on the basis of on the satisfaction of our voluntarily chosen preferences. They can just coercively get the funds and then do what they want. So again, we want to move decision-making out of the hands of state officials back into the hands of entrepreneurs. This would certainly overcome one of the limits of the division of labor. And in the division of labor, in the market, we have, I gave an example of this before, we have the self-selection process in the market by monetary incentive. So we don't have to have government officials, you know, choosing who's going to do what and assigning people to different productive tasks. We get this efficiency of self-selection. So if we had government officials involved in assigning tasks, they would assign tasks. I mean, if they wanted to do this in the most reasonable way, I suppose, they would do this according to proficiency. They would see who the most proficient assembly line worker was, and they put that person on the assembly line to put together the widgets. But they don't know what the opportunity cost is. They might, when Tim Cook was just a college student, they might have, you know, assigned him to be an accountant or to be a widget maker or something. When he turned out to be, I was going to say great entrepreneur, but that the jury's still out, I guess, whether he's great or not. But certainly a good entrepreneur. So without self-selecting in the market, we can't have any indication of what these opportunity costs are. And so the market provides for that full self-selection process. The entrepreneurs offering us positions, they're selecting us for different positions in the division of labor, and we select them as owners of the factors of production. We choose the job out of the array of things that we're offered. And so this, again, improves efficiency. We should have this sort of thing. And then finally, accumulating capital. This is the last thing we want to discuss. Now, when we talk about lengthening the capital structure, The process of lengthening the capital structure occurs in the following manner. People first reduce or lower the intensity of their time preferences. So all of us have a certain degree of preference for present satisfaction over future satisfaction, for having our satisfaction satisfied sooner as opposed to later. If this preference is reduced in intensity, then we would be more willing to forego present consumption and save and invest. If we save and invest more, then we are devoting more resources to the building up of capital capacity, and the additional capital capacity makes us more productive. So this, in a nutshell, is the theory of economic growth, or theory of economic progress. Right? It depends upon the extent of our time preferences. So time preferences go down, we save and invest more, we devote more resources to producing the capital structure, the array of capital productive capacity. And doing this makes us more physically productive, but doing it also lengthens out production processes in time. Because first we have to produce the capital capacity before we can produce the consumer goods, whereas before we were producing the consumer goods more directly. So this is the idea of lengthening out the capital structure. And then in the process of lengthening out the capital structure, we integrate new technology. And this, too, depends upon the entrepreneur's determination of what is economizing. So technology is not like an independent force that somehow impresses itself upon human history. In the market, it's chosen. And the different lines of technological improvement are also invested in by the capitalists and the entrepreneurs, and then integrated into production. So we get to all the various different kinds of useful technology that is appropriate in given the complementary factors of production that exist in our capital structure. So it would be great to have those beaming devices that they have on Star Trek. As we just beam ourselves all over the world and beam, we wouldn't have trucks hauling stuff around anymore. We just beam our cargo here and there. But we may physically know how to do this. There may be some sort of weird physics theory that allows for this. I don't know. But the problem is we don't have the capital capacity. We don't have the requisite complementary capital goods to produce this thing. And that's why we're not investing in it right now. Our investment in technology is better invested in technology that we can actually implement given our capital structure. So this is where the improvement of technology comes from. All right, so let's take, we'll just use briefly an illustration of how Caruso does this. Again, this just gives us the basic principles, and then you can apply this to the more complicated cases of the real world. So let's say Caruso has this new technology of catching fish. And instead of using his bare hands, it's catching fish with a net. So he hits upon this idea, not a very advanced technology, but still one that would improve his productivity if he can embody this in a capital structure. And so he searches around the island and he finds that he can do this and he engages in stages of production, a capital structure to produce this net that requires him to save and invest. So in the third stage, this we call the highest stage, he extracts the raw materials out of nature. He walks around and gathers vine and twine that's suitable for constructing the net. And this, let's say this takes him 7 half-hour units of labor. And then in the second stage, he goes back to his cave where he's living, and he weaves together the net. He fashions the net. So that takes him 5 units of labor. And then once he has the net, he fishes with it. That's the consumer goods production stage, the first stage, or the lowest stage of this production structure. And then he would have a marginal physical product of his labor in fishing. And again, it would exhibit diminishing returns because, as an economizing person, if what's he's, he could be a recreational fisher if he wanted and he wouldn't care how many fish he got, that would be one thing. But we're assuming he's interested in production. And so he's going to go to the most productive areas in the stream first. He's going to scope that out and find out where the best fishing is or what time of day is the best and so on. He's going to get the most fish. Then he exhausts that and he goes to a less productive area with his next unit of labor and so on and so forth. And so he exhibits this diminishing returns. And then the other question, the next step, of course, is how does he value these? He's going to allocate his labor into these different activities, fishing with the net or gathering coconuts or picking berries, depending upon, as we said before, his marginal value product. So he let's say he ranks things so that five fish is ranked above six coconuts, is ranked above two quarts of berries. So each of these he can produce with one unit of labor. But the other consideration we have to bring in into this discussion now is time. Because the production of the fish takes an extended amount of time for him to produce the requisite capital goods so that he can have the net and then produce the consumer goods. So he can't have five fish or six coconuts or two quarts of berries at the same moment of time in the future. In fact, I'm just assuming that he would do it this way, what he chooses to do is invest over 6 days. Remember, it takes 12 units of his labor to produce the net. So he chooses to invest 2 units of his labor each day over the next 6 days to get the net. And then on the sixth day, he catches five fish. And then he ranks that against, he could have five fish, in other words, in 6 days, or he could have six coconuts in a half hour today, or he could have two quarts of berries in a half hour. Now, where he ranks the fish, depending on the time, his time preference, depends upon his conditions. So before he engages in what we call plane saving, saving consumer goods, so he has a stock of these consumer goods to allow him to save and invest, so he can shift his labor to producing the net while he's not producing coconuts and berries, so he doesn't have anything to eat or consume. He's going to save over a few days some of the coconuts and berries and then eat them while he's gathering the twine and so on. So once he engages in plane saving, then he would value the net and he would use it to he would produce it and catch the fish. So his decision to construct the net, oh, and by the way, in the complex social world, this is just capital investment, right? It's just a capitalist and an entrepreneur deciding what line to invest in. Where am I going to build up my capital capacity? What kind of factory will I build? Where would I put it? And so on. They do the same kind of consideration. They say, what are the sum of the values of the producer goods that are created by the net, discounted by my time preference, and compare the sum of those with the value of the things forgone. The asset value of the plant facility from building it and the liabilities engaged. So let's say his preferences look like this. So he Caruso values five, he's going to get five fish per week. That's how he's going to use the net once he has it. And the net's going to last 25 weeks. And he can start this production in 6 days. And after 25 days of using the net, it disintegrates and isn't useful anymore. He values that more than the goods he foregoes by constructing the net. And let's say, again, each day over the 6 days, he gets up an hour of sleeping and an hour of berry picking. And then he's going to have maintenance costs, right, in parenthesis there. So that's how he decides. And maybe he decides again that yes, it's worth it to me to invest in the net, and maybe he decides it's not. That's again a matter of economizing given his values. Okay, so just to summarize this, his capital accumulation, he first chooses the extent of his saving and investing, his time preference, as we say, and then he would invest in the different lines of capital goods that give the greatest difference between the value of what he obtains and the value of what he gives up. The fish are very valuable to him, and he doesn't give up very valuable alternatives, then he would invest in nets. Now, once he has one net, it's unlikely that he would immediately invest in a second net, right? Because the marginal value product of the second net would fall. What would he do with the second net until the first one wears out? It would just sit around. So he probably wouldn't do that. He would go to another line of investment and invest in a different capital good, just like we do in the real economy. We invest where the rates of return are higher, but more investing there dries them down until there's no value advantage in investing any further in oil fracking, or you know, whatever the new activity might be. Okay, so So he obtains the greatest value from this capital accumulation by investing in this fashion, where the value differences are made the same at the margin in all things. And as we do this over time, then we become more physically productive, the human population can grow, and not only do we have more people, but each of us lives at a higher physical standard of living. All right, we've exhausted our time, so we'll quit there. Thank you.